Radio Free Charleston is on the air.
Welcome to Radio Free Charleston. I'm your host, Rudy Panucci. We opened our show with The Ghost of Now doing Death Burn. And this is a departure episode for our show. If you read the Pop Cult blog, you probably already know that we lost Lee Hara on Thanksgiving night. And Lee was one of my best friends. And I know there are a lot of people who could say that. Lee was a great friend to a lot of people. And if you've listened to the air for a while, you realize this is the man who used to host Hera's Hard and Heavy. He was my co-host on Word Association with Lee and Rudy. And I'm interrupting the Best of 2025 episodes so that we can pay tribute to Lee this week. You're going to hear some of his music. That was him singing just now. You're going to hear him again in a moment. I am going to intersperse that with music by Lee's musical heroes, because he deserves to stand shoulder in shoulder with the Ramones and Creedence Clearwater Revival and Iron Maiden and Typo Negative and others. I'll tell you a little bit about that when we play those songs. I'm also going to bring you three episodes of Word Association with Lee and Rudy. If you didn't get to know Lee, you might get to know him a little bit by listening to our conversations about some familiar topics. We are going to continue with our tribute to Lee with Hera, his most recent band, and Nothing Me on Radio Free Charleston on the air.
My soul is sad.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, we have a multitude of problems.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Radio Free Charleston.
Can I play with madness?
Thank you.
lesson is just what most of us really need. You keep the home vibes burning when the light goes still. You showed us so much by not giving in. So long now since I've heard the word. It was the most painful thing that I think I've ever heard. But deep down inside, I know you'll be okay. You're too damn strong to fade out or to burn away. Yeah.
That was Stone Quartet with Adam's Song. Stone Quartet was another band that Lee fronted, and Adam is his nephew who battled cancer, and Adam, thankfully, is still with us. Before that, we had Typo Negative with Love You to Death. Peter Steele, one of Lee's heroes. Iron Maiden gave us Can I Play with Madness. You're going to hear a little more Maiden later on. And we had Creedence Clearwater Revival with Green River. If you knew Lee, you knew that he loved Creedence. And before that, the Ramones with Rock and Roll High School. Lee loved Joey Ramone. He hated Johnny Ramone. He made sure that I mentioned that in his obituary. But anyway, that was our first set of music. And right now we are going to bring you the very first episode of Word Association with Lee and Rudy. The premise of this show was I would spring a topic on Lee, and we would talk about it for half an hour. And some of the topics I picked, I basically just nodded for half an hour while Lee talked. The first episode, I served him up a big old softball. So here's a half hour of Lee telling me about the Hulk on Word Association on Radio Free Charleston on the air. It's time for Word Association with Lee Hara and Rudy Panucci on the air. Here's how it works. Each week, Lee Hara and Rudy Panucci sit down and spend half an hour discussing a random topic. Lee Hara never knows in advance what that topic will be. Sometimes Rudy Panucci doesn't know either. Time is kept by a little kitchen timer shaped like an Italian chef, whom we have named Luigi. Sit back for half an hour of random talk. The views and opinions expressed in Word Association with Lee Hara and Rudy Panucci are not representative of anyone. Proceed at your own risk. Welcome to Word Association with Lee Hara and Rudy Panucci.
I'm Lee Hara.
I'm Rudy Panucci. And we are going to jump right into things this week. The word about which we will hold a discussion for the next half hour is the Hulk. By the way, Lee doesn't know in advance what the topic of the show will be.
No, I didn't.
I decided to give you an easy one.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay, so what is this Hulk thing anyway? Is it popular with the kids?
He is now.
Okay.
And I think he was in the 70s, too, when a little TV show came out about the...
He was on the Love Boat?
No, okay. He might have been on later.
Let's go back to the prehistoric times. Created by
Jack Kirby and Stan Lee.
And that's a topic for another show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And actually, the first six issues included some work that was Jack Kirby inked by Steve Ditko.
That's true. That's very true.
The two artistic architects of Marvel Comics.
Oh, yeah. Can't touch the king.
And after six issues, the Hulk comic book sort of died.
Yeah, yeah, it did. I think it was because of the whole, you know, Marvel Comics on its way out kind of thing.
Well, it was, they didn't have the best distribution. They were dependent on National Periodical Publications, which
right.
was DC Comics, and their main competition. So, after six issues, the book was canceled, but the character did not go away.
No.
He was in the Avengers.
Yeah, he was in the Avengers, but also he became a
co-feature.
Co-feature besides Ant-Man, or Giant-Man or Ant-Man or whatever you want to call him, in Tales to Astonish.
Right.
And then after a while, Giant-Man or Ant-Man, again, whatever, Hank Pym.
Well, it was one of the things that Marvel did in the 60s was they had split titles when they didn't have enough faith because of their distribution agreement, which limited them to a certain amount of titles. So they didn't want to give all their solo stars their own books because they didn't have the books to give them.
That's true.
So they would do split books. They had, what was it? Tales to Astonish had the Hulk and
Giant Man in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hank Pym.
Then there was...
then I think after about four or five issues...
Captain America shared his book with who?
Falcon.
No, in the 60s.
In the 60s?
It was Captain America on one side and Was it Iron Man?
No, I don't think Iron Man ever shared a book
with
him.
Yeah, he
did. Did he?
Yeah.
Wow, see, now that's one that blew right
there.
So
there were several split titles, and then what would happen is they would give one of the characters would get a new number one, and the other would take over the numbering of the book.
Well,
that's what happened to Thor with Journey into Mystery.
Right, right. And see, the same thing happened in Tales to Astonish, because, like I said, after a while, Pym ended up going away, and I think they built him in with the Avengers later on. But it became the Submariner and the Hulk.
Right.
And
the Submariner got a new number one.
Right. Well, what went on is, like, I think this is one of the first times in recorded history that it happened in comic book history. Vote for who takes over this title.
Right, but that was actually just a gimmick that Stan Lee cooked up. They had got a new distribution deal, so they could suddenly have unlimited titles.
Oh.
So that's why Daredevil didn't have to share his book with anybody, because he came along at a time when they were like, okay, let's just give him a whole book.
Well, and the X-Men too, right?
Well, no, they didn't make the team books share. It was like the X-Men, they felt it was a team, so they didn't have enough. Yeah, they had too many characters to cram into half a book.
Right.
But the X-Men was a sort of a struggling title, really, until 75 when they relaunched it. Giant-size X-Men.
Right, right.
But I think the book had been in reprints for 3 years before that.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the later titles were just retellings of everything else.
They were just reprints of the original stories.
Right, right.
But getting back to the Hulk.
But, yeah. And
he became a star character, one of the major players in the Marvel Universe, and a lot of people credit that to his strength crossing over with Fantastic Four and appearing in the Avengers, and that it was Stan Lee's determination not to let that character die.
Well, and I'll tell you what else, too. As far as I know, and I mean, if there's someone out there that can prove me wrong, go for it. That crossover where it had the Fantastic Four, and the Avengers and Spider-Man all fighting the Hulk. And it was it was in between the Fantastic Four and the Avengers titles.
Well, again, that was the way that Stan Lee kept the character visible.
Right,
right. Eventually the Hulk became a major, by 1968, he was a major character in Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
And so then we have the 70s, where the Hulk is so popular, they had him leave the Avengers, actually, early on, because
Loki's influence on him.
Well, it just didn't make sense, though. He wasn't really a traditional team player.
No.
To have him, being an outlaw on the run in his own book, and then, fighting alongside Captain America.
Well, and they actually replaced the Hulk, or they replaced the Hulk with Captain America.
Yeah.
Because when the Hulk went on his rampage...
Right, they would occasionally bring the Hulk back, and then, it never worked out.
Right.
But in the 70s, mid-70s, they decided to try again and put him in a team with other characters who didn't play well with others. The Defenders.
And the first few issues of the Defenders was absolutely awesome, because that tension... the tension of these...
They have him teamed with Doctor Strange.
Namor, the Silver Surfer, and the Hulk. I think that was the original core of the team.
The Silver Surfer, I think they took out early.
Right, right. Well,
again... And they created Valkyrie.
Yeah, what do you want with Jesus Christ with a surfboard,
Yeah. Again, that's a topic for another show. But then the TV show happened.
Oh,
the Hulk was such a high-visibility character... His book was selling well. I think at that point, Sal Buscema had replaced Herb Trimpe as the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And
and Marie Severin, too. Between Marie Severin and Herb Trimpe, Buscema took over after those two.
Yeah, I remember. Well, Marie was inking.
Right. Well, I think she penciled a good bit of the stuff, too.
Yeah, she's very versatile. And doesn't get enough credit for being a pioneering woman cartoonist.
No.
Industry.
I mean, because some of the most famous, iconic... pictures of the Hulk from the 70s, that was a lot of her work.
She also did a lot of the retouching on covers for Marvel when John Romita was not available.
Right, right.
Because they trusted her enough to give her that.
Well, and she just had an incredible way of art,
And then I remember the 1976 Hulk Annual, penciled by Buscema, inked by Jack Abel. Bill Mantlo write that?
think so.
Yeah, and that was where they brought back all the cheesy old Atlas Comics monsters to fight the Hulk, including Groot.
Oh, yeah!
And to this day, I have always been astonished by how some of Marvel's crappiest throwaway characters just a few years later become massive successes. But getting back to what we were talking about, the Hulk, 1978, what happens?
1978.
TV show.
Well, you're right, yeah, the TV show blows up. Not to mention the fact he, at this point, is considered the Rook in the Mego toy company.
Right, is the Marvel characters had gone from obscurity in the 60s, early 60s, rapidly became cool with the college crowd, and then by the 70s, the books were outselling DC, and they were merchandisable. And so you had Spider-Man and the Hulk were on the same level with Superman and Batman, almost, in terms of selling toys.
Well, I got to pull you back a couple years, too, for something major that happened.
Yeah?
The Harlan Ellison run that introduced Jor-El.
That was one story.
And, well, but it was pinnacle because it was the first time the Hulk was smart.
Yeah.
And that was something nobody had ever seen before.
Right.
And, you know, it was a telling of things to come with that character and the development
we don't completely leave the audience in the dust, Harlan Ellison is a prominent writer of speculative fiction because he hates the term sci-fi.
But he coined the shit.
He wrote for Outer Limits. He did a lot of TV work.
He created the Andorians and Star Trek.
Exactly.
He created the Andorian race.
City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of that stuff.
Plus, his books and his anthologies and his books of criticism. The Glass Teat and the Other Glass Teat. Great essays about TV and how horrible he thought TV was in the 70s. God only knows what he would write. Well, actually, he's still with us, so we need to speak of him in the past tense.
Well, but he don't do a whole lot of TV stuff anymore.
Well, he's recovering from a stroke, but apparently...
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, he was in the hospital last year and...
No kidding!
Never lost the ability to speak or rant at people. And
That does not surprise me in the least, especially with him.
Anyway, when he would touch a property, he would leave something lasting in it, and he did that with the Hulk.
Right, and that's one of the things that really, as a kid... Because I ended up getting the reprints.
Right.
Because I've got tons of quote-unquote Marvel Superheroes presents The Incredible Hulk, and it retold a lot of the Tales to Astonish.
And that was actually another sign of the popularity of the character.
Yeah.
Because Marvel, in the 70s, when Marvel had the control of their distribution, they flooded the market. And if they had a character that they thought was hot, they would publish as many books as possible, and that meant reprinting their early stories. Tales was the Spider-Man reprint book.
Right,
and that
took
off, and, that's why they put the Hulk in the Defenders.
Well, but that Marvel Superheroes title, I'll like try to go and collect some of those just to have them in my sets. And some of those are just as expensive as the original prints.
Right.
I mean, because I tried to get issue 102, which is technically, it was Tales to Astonish ended at issue 101. Mm-hmm. And the Incredible Hulk's premiere issue was 102. So technically the Hulk, like you said, have had two number ones.
Right.
And what you had said previously, from issue 1970, the Incredible Hulk came out as issue 102 from number one. And, of course, the title ended, I believe, in 1999 at 474 with Volume 1.
Right.
And then they started rebooting it constantly after.
Yeah, which is another topic.
Right. But that particular bit...
Let's get back to...
That's what I'm saying. The Marvel superheroes featuring the Incredible Hulk took it all the way up to, I believe, the mid-80s, which is where I'll plop us after.
Let's go back up to 1978.
Oh, 78.
We sort of have to discuss a TV show.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The TV show
was where the Hulk became mainstream.
Oh, yeah.
It was, I think, a top 20 TV show.
Oh, top 10.
Top 10.
In fact, I believe it was even number one for a little while.
Okay.
And what really kind of...
They had that really moved a lot of toys.
And you know what really irks me as a child then and as an adult now? Mm-hmm. There has never been a proper, officially licensed Bill Bixby or Lou Ferrigno.
Right.
You realize they didn't make a Bruce Banner figure until 1996. And with the exception of Mini Mates, they've never made a General Ross. I'm not counting the Red Hulk. I'm saying General Ross. They've only made one Mini Mate of him.
Stop again for a second. Remember, we have a listening audience now who may not be familiar with who General Ross is or who Bill Bixby is.
Oh, well. Bill Bixby
was Eddie's father.
And he was a magician.
Yeah, but
he was in My Favorite Martian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he got around, but he was
beautiful.
David
actor.
William Bruce Bob Billy Joe Sam Banner.
Yeah, Bruce. David Bruce Banner. What yeah. Did you hear about that? Why they changed
I knew there were a lot of different reasons.
It was over Batman.
Well, yeah, I heard that it was over Batman because of Bruce Wayne, but then I also heard that it was because in the 70s. The name Bruce had homosexual connotations.
Yeah!
And
it was greatly due to Batman having a little boy.
Right, that was the theory that Bruce developed gay connotations.
And that's why I just rolled my eyes at. And David was such a popular name in the 70s.
But wasn't he also Robert Bruce Banner?
In the comic books, he was Robert Bruce Banner. And the reason why they did that,
Stan Lee
forgot his name.
Right.
Because if you think about it, Peter Parker, Matt Murdock, Reed Richards, come on, throw some more at me.
Well, Bob Banner.
Well, but what it was going to be Bruce Banner or Robert Banner.
Yeah.
But then they were like, wait a minute, you already named him. His name's Robert. Oh, well then he's Robert Bruce Banner.
Yeah.
So he just quickly threw it together. So he was one of the few Marvel properties that actually
did not have alliteration.
Right. And see, it was always the same first letter began.
Johnny Storm.
Right. Well, but you know, I mean, but most of the time, it all the more poignant characters all had that name. You know, mm-hmm. like I said, Matt Murdock, Bruce Banner, Peter Parker,
Conan Cohen, the Jewish barbarian.
Oy vey.
Yes. But anyway, so we're back. We got this TV show. It's a massive success.
Oh, man.
Ran until...
1982?
And then they did TV movies for a few years after that.
Yeah. Some of those were hit and miss.
Yeah, they were attempts to launch new characters on TV that didn't really work. So they had, like, Daredevil, and I think he was, dressed in black.
Yeah, Rex Smith.
With no horns, and then they did the Thor, which elicits laughter.
But the dude was perfect.
Yeah.
He was big, he was burly, he was muscular. It was the guy holding the hammer and going, Odin, and the big lightning bolt, and then Thor shows up. Before Hemsworth reared his lovely face on the screen, it was the wrapping of a lame man's cane.
If we ever do a show about Thor, I do have to mention how he's really basically a rip-off of Shazam.
Oh, yeah.
Of Captain Marvel.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But getting back to
the
Hulk, then after the 80s, the Hulk, in the comic books, the Hulk's popularity...
Dwindled
a little bit. I mean, he had some good creative runs with Peter David writing like 8 million issues.
Actually, it was Mantlo up till Peter David.
Oh, okay.
And Mantlo did handle a lot of that.
Yeah, there's some debate about that, because Bill Mantlo is sort of a tragic figure because he busted his ass writing for Marvel, and he did what many people consider to be unspectacular work for most of his career with a few highlights.
But, man, he created the origin issue of
Hulk. No, what I'm saying is he had some highlights, but a lot of it was like, who can get this done on time? Let's get Bill.
Actually.
And he worked his way through law school.
Actually, no. Wait a minute. The Barry Windsor Smith thing.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, because see, that was 1984 cusping into 85.
Right. Barry Windsor Smith came up with a story he wanted to tell with the Hulk, and he pitched to Marvel, and they turned him down. And then that story basically got adapted anyway by Bill Mantlo. And
issue 312.
Who was drawing it then? Jerry Talley?
No. Oh. Believe it or not, I'm going to let you answer this. Who is the artist I hate the most?
Todd McFarlane.
No, I can actually,
No, that's the one I hate the most.
Yeah, you hate him the most.
Anyway, go ahead, tell me.
The guy that gives me the headaches.
Oh, Magnolia.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was incredible when he drew the Hulk. Because it was after issue 300.
Didn't they have, like, Ruben Yandock inking him or something?
I don't know, but it was, but that was some of his finest work besides the Rocket Raccoon 5 issue.
Jumping back, though.
Whose first appearance happened to be in the Hulk, too?
Wolverine had become the hot character. The X-Men were still
first appearance in the Hulk as well.
Exactly. All roads lead back to the Hulk.
But it does, in a lot of ways.
And Todd McFarlane made his first major splash on the Hulk.
And Peter David made his strongest groundbreaking points with the Hulk.
So creatively,
he actually won tons of
him.
Eisner Awards.
Right, but it was creatively a great time for the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
Late 80s, early 90s. But merchandising sort of disappeared.
Speaking of annuals, here's one that I love. There was one particular annual, I can't remember the number of it, but I collect this one rapidly. Rick Jones, the kid that Banner saves, he becomes very, very, he becomes a poignant staple in the comic book and in the series.
Right.
He goes to FAO Schwartz, and he's like, hey, I just got all these new Marvel figures that came out, and this was the very first run of the Toy Biz line. This very shoddy, very cheesy, terrible thing. He's like, look, the Punisher's got a cap gun on his back, and he's got all these weapons. And you hear the Hulk quietly go, I got a rock. What? And he's like, and Spider-Man's got these suction cup hands, and the Silver Surfer's got a pullback board. I got a rock. And all, like, the Hulk came with a little bending bar.
Yeah.
He still had the ripped pants. He still had the Hulk smash stuff. But by this time, he had the intellect of Banner, the attitude of the Grey Hulk, and was commanding a secret society of ancient warriors.
And dialogue from Charlie Brown.
Yeah. But he, through that whole thing, all he kept saying while Rick was critiquing all the other figures, I got a rock. Mm-hmm. I remember laughing so hard at that. And again, during the 90s, during Peter David's run, because you had McFarlane, then after McFarlane you had a, I believe he was Filipino as well, Jeff Purves. Only time that dude ever really did anything, as far as I know.
Okay.
And he did the Grey Hulk saga with Mr. Fix-It in Las Vegas. Well, then that ended up going to Dale Keown.
For the mainstream audience, this could be very confusing because they're used to the Lou Ferrigno Hulk.
Right.
They're not used to Smart Hulk or Grey Hulk or Hulk wearing a tuxedo or Hulk drawn by Todd McFarlane with God only knows what kind of anatomy.
He was a cancer patient. He made him look like a big, giant cancer. That's why he didn't have muscle tone.
Okay.
And that was one of the things that kind of endeared me to McFarlane's work, because he made everything else chiseled and muscular, but he made the Grey Hulk just all clammy and like a big, giant tumor with eyes.
But we're running a little low on time, so we need to make a leap from the 90s into the Marvel Cinematic Universe and a couple of false starts.
Oh.
Yes. So,
well, hit me.
Well, hit you. After years of trying, Marvel finally had a successful movie with the first Spider-Man movie by Sam Raimi.
If you call it that.
Well, actually, they had a success earlier with the X-Men.
Well, that is true.
The X-Men films, they had to basically give away the rights to the characters to get the films made, which is why Fox still owns the X-Men. And
that's a whole nother mess for a whole nother time.
Right. But then you had Spider-Man show that a solo Marvel traditional character could be successful. So they decided to try to launch the Hulk. So they're like, who should we get? Why don't we get a guy who makes 3-hour-long Japanese art movies to make a Hulk movie? That makes perfect sense.
Peter David's novelization of the book was incredible.
Yeah.
Of the movie, it was incredible.
The problem I had with the movie was the action sequences were great. And if you cut out everything but those, it's a wonderful movie. It's sort of like The Man of Steel.
Yeah.
You know, If you cut out everything but the superhero flying around hitting things.
Well, see, I bet low. I just wanted to see a big giant green dude in purple pants smashing army tanks.
Right.
I got what I wanted. And Eric Bana wasn't the best Bruce Banner. He was too built. He was too tall.
Yeah.
He overacted a whole lot in parts. It, just because he played the chopper was how he got the role of Bruce Banner. It was a Australian movie about a guy in prison. A great performance in that. I'll give you that. But Banner just didn't have it.
See, the perfect guy I think they should have got, but by that point he's probably too old, was Jeffrey Combs.
Jeffrey Combs would have been awesome, but see, me personally, if you want my Bruce Banner, it was either Steve Buscemi or Edward Norton. They got it. Because Edward Norton had such a grip on MPD.
Buscemi I see more as the Lizard in Spider-Man.
Well, but see, a wiry guy with the hair in front and just, you know, that was kind of how I saw Banner as well. But Edward Norton...
they did something rare with that, because the movie, did it turn a profit?
It turned a profit for the first weekend, and then everybody that went and saw it told everybody else, don't go see it, it sucks.
So
it bottomed out.
That was the first Marvel movie that they rebooted.
And then they did that.
5 years later?
Yeah. With Louis Leterrier as director of the Transporter series. Mm. And then they had Edward Norton, they had Tim Roth, and those guys, the three, that nuclei.
I'd say Tim Roth would have made a good Banner.
Yeah, he would have, because the Hulk and Superman were his two favorite comic books he read. But Edward Norton, as a kid in Boston, read Captain America, Spider-Man, and the Hulk. And he absolutely loved the Hulk. The Hulk was his favorite.
Yeah, I don't go by what they read when they're grown up.
Yeah. Oh, well,
Al Roker grew up on Superman and Batman, but I wouldn't want to see him play either one of them.
Well, but if they're an actor and they would already fit the criteria, and he even used Bruce Banner as a small influence as the narrator in Fight Club. Mm-hmm. That was what sold me. When I saw him in Fight Club, I'm like, oh my God, it's the Calvin and Hobbes story from hell, and he's perfect. He'd be a perfect Bruce Banner.
So, the second movie...
It was incredible, and it was my favorite. It is still my favorite, and I will wrestle anyone down and say it is the modern preempt of the Avengers.
And yet...
It bombed.
It did not...
Batman Summer. Another time I can thank Batman for punching my character in the short and curlies.
Well, I don't think it was all Batman. I think it was at that point, Marvel had not gotten their full marketing plan in place.
Right, right. But plus...
That was after Iron Man.
Yeah, because that movie had a whole lot of firsts. And the first that really stands is it was the first superhero movie to feature another superhero from another existing franchise. Mm-hmm. And at the very end of it, when Ross is in the bar drinking a drink, in comes Robert Downey Jr. As Tony Stark, and he looks at him and says, what if I told you we were putting a team together?
But again, they planted the seeds of that in Iron Man when Samuel L. Jackson showed up.
But see, remember, he wasn't an existing character in another movie, though.
Right.
That was Nick Fury's
first movie.
Right. But again, the closest we had to it was in Batman and Robin, when Batman tells Robin, you know, you can only get to Metropolis from here.
Yeah.
That's the closest we ever got.
Also had, in the Iron Man movie, you had Captain America's shield laying on a table in the background.
Captain America's shield was supposed to be in the opening credits of the Hulk.
Right. And they do the DVD bonus where the Hulk finds the frozen Captain America and throws him?
No. What it is, he goes to kill himself.
Oh, okay.
And he's up at the Northern Lights and he sees the Aurora Borealis and he starts having flashbacks. And he loses it, Hulk's out, punches the ground. And you see this shockwave of ice, and if you look really close to the far left of your screen, you'll see Captain America's shield and possibly him in it. Right. And there you go. That was supposed to be how
it
started. That
was the beginning of the very successful Marvel
Cinematic Universe,
which is why today the Hulk is a hugely marketable character who, for whatever reasons, does not have his own movie.
Well, they're supposed to work on it. I think they're waiting for Ragnarok to come out because apparently...
I heard that they're keeping him out of Civil War because if they put him in that story, it would end it in 5 minutes.
Oh, that's what I said when the comic book started. You know, I was like, that's why they had to send him away.
Right.
And I think that's why he's going to end up with Thor in Ragnarok.
Right.
Because apparently from what I've been reading on the internet and whatever, it's supposed to be like a buddy cop movie.
But you now have an iconic character
who is
basically... Oh, heck, we have to stop. And the thing fell over, too.
Well, can I add
one more
thing?
Make one last point, yeah.
Mark Ruffalo, the guy that I didn't think that would pull his weight, he did a spectacular and stellar job as Bruce Banner. Although I kind of wish that they would have still stuck with Norton, but I can see why they didn't. But I can't wait to see what he's going to do next.
Right. But what I was going to say, to wrap it up, the Hulk, it's Jekyll and Hyde.
Frankenstein.
Jekyll and Hyde in the post-atomic age.
Mm-hmm.
You've got character who turns into a monster and turns green and jumps around, just like in the Jekyll and Hyde novel.
That's very true.
Sort of.
Well, yeah.
But
because he did leap on the rooftops a whole lot.
But we're done. The man rang and fell off of a little tower there. So, thank you for listening to Word Association with Lee Hara and Rudy Panucci.
Hulk smash.
Come back next week where we will talk about more stuff of whatever we want to talk about. See you then.
Totally.
Okay.
Word Association with Lee Hara and Rudy Panucci is brought to you by General Substances.
If it's composed of matter, we have a hand or two in it.
They say that nightmares are dreams for me. I've told them here was it a nightmare.
I think of death.
But they don't believe me.
Always death.
But there's so little time left.
Get out.
You've got to listen. What they did to me,
like I was losing.
What they're doing now. They're waiting for you.
We'll be right back.
one by one. And no one will hear you scream!
That was Harrow with Blood Moon, based on a really cool movie that's now in the public domain, so I was able to cut together a music video for that. You'll probably see that on the video episode of Radio Free Charleston in a couple of weeks, because this year's video episode of Radio Free Charleston will also be sort of a Best of Lee Harrow episode. We are going to continue with our tribute to Lee Harrow on Radio Free Charleston with The Ghost of Now. This was the band Lee was in when I first met him. And this is a song written by his bass player, Roadblock, Jason Robinson. Roadblock and Lee had a major falling out and were not close when Lee passed away. But when I had Ghost of Now on the Radio Free Charleston video show back in 2007... Roadblock was the one who got in touch with me first, and at the time, those two were inseparable. And this is a song that Roadblock wrote. It's Alaska Looks Like Arizona. It's The Ghost of Now on Radio Free Charleston on the air.
What did they ever do to you? song. Been away so long, I hardly knew the place. Gee, it seems to be my home. Leaving until tomorrow to invite my case. Finally, disconnect the phone. I'm like a USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the US, back in the US, back in the USSR. Girls really knock me out of the room, the less behind. And most of the girls take me sing and shout. And Georgia's always on my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind. Show me around the smoking mountains way down the south. Take me to your daddy's farm. Let me hang about the light is ringing out. Come and keep your comrade warm. I'm back in the USSR. Don't know what you are, boy. Back in the USSR. USSR. Big girls really knock me out. Leave the West behind. And most old girls make me sing and shout. And Georgia's always on my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind, my mind. Oh, show me when the smoky mountains way down south. Take me to your daddy's farm. Let me hear your bellow like it's ringing out. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boy. Back in the USSR. Hey! I'm back!
Is that first you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has...
Radio Free Charleston.
Take it on back. Get back. Thank you.
just heard Stone Quartet. Lee was the front man for Stone Quartet before I met him. When I first met him, he was in the Ghost of Now, and later he formed his own band, Hera. And those are the songs I have handy to drop in the show. Before that, you heard the Beatles doing Now and Then. And I dropped that in for personal reasons. I played that for Lee in the car one time when it had just come out, and he was almost moved to tears. He really loved Paul McCartney's voice, and he had a warm spot for the Beatles, as so many people do. And it seemed appropriate. Before that, another one of Lee's favorites, Tina Turner, did her version of Get Back. And before that, Lemmy and Friends gave us Back in the USSR. That was sort of our little Beatles tribute in the middle of the show. Lee, despite being a headbanger and a metal aficionado, appreciated older music and was a big fan of the Beatles, which was amazing because his mother detested the Beatles. Seriously. If you knew Mickey, you knew that. Anyway, speaking of things that Lee loved, here's an episode of Word Association with Lee and Rudy devoted to George Romero on the air. It's time for Word Association with Lee Hera and Rudy Panucci on the air. Here's how it works. Each week, Lee Hera and Rudy Panucci sit down and spend half an hour discussing a random topic. Lee Hera never knows in advance what that topic will be. Sometimes Rudy Panucci doesn't know either. Time is kept by a little kitchen timer shaped like an Italian chef whom we have named Luigi. Sit back for half an hour of random talk. The views and opinions expressed in Word Association with Lee Hera and Rudy Panucci are not representative of anyone. Proceed at your own risk. Hello and welcome to Word Association with Lee and Rudy. Guess what? This is the first episode of the show we've done this year.
How long has it been?
I don't know. I think it's September when we're recording this.
Well, I mean, I know it's September now, but when was the last Word Association?
We did a batch late last year, and then things happened.
Yeah, a whole lot of stuff happened.
We'll talk about that maybe on another show.
Yes, another show.
But we are going to talk about something. Well, we're going to try to be positive, but bittersweet. Because we have a topic this week that's a little sad, but we can celebrate.
What's that?
The father, George Romero. We got to talk about George Romero.
Hell yeah.
We just lost him over the summer. And it sucks.
God
but
damn it.
We had him, and we have his movies, and we have an everlasting legacy of terrific film work. That
social commentary like none other.
And still influencing people.
Damn right.
Yeah, and there's an entire industry based on one of his movies.
Well, and I mean, literally creating a genre that people now will go out of their way to say, oh, I'm an expert on, but have no idea who his name is.
Let's talk about that genre. We're talking about zombies. We're talking about Night
of the Living Dead. The dead that won't die. A Night of Total Terror.
That movie, 1968. 68.
Same year Easy Rider, or between the time Easy Rider and it was coming out.
Well, Easy Rider came out 69.
Yeah.
Easy Rider was being made. But that was part of the same wave of Hollywood, big budget Hollywood movies had crashed and burned, and fewer people were going to see them. And that's very relevant because that's sort of what's happening right now.
Well, because Dennis Hopper, when he was playing Mr. Kaufman in Land of the Dead, him and George sat and had this huge powwow about that. And he's like, you know, while I was trying to get Easy Rider out there, he said, you already had Night of the Living Dead out there and already was shocking crowds.
And that was the thing. Movie distribution was completely different back then. It was like a carnival game.
Oh, yeah.
You had people who would take, you know, they call it four-walling.
Right.
They'd have one print of a movie and take it all over the country and do different engagements. And, you know... and Night of the Living Dead was one of those films, and that's actually why the movie is in the public domain, because their distributor was so shitty.
Well, not just that. The movie was originally called Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Right, and the distributor said, we have to change that, but they didn't copyright...
The goddamn name.
They didn't copyright the new name, and it slipped into the public domain.
And that's why when you buy a bowl of like... Halloween soup, it comes with a free copy of Night of the Living Dead.
Right.
And I always just found, I found that so disgusting, you know?
Yeah.
But
it ended up with some really weird creative things happening. Have you seen the reanimated Night of the Living Dead?
What?
There was a project where hundreds of people collaborated on, they would take 15-second snippets of Night of the Living Dead and animate it.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah,
really?
It's all over the internet and Roku and stuff.
Oh, man, I need to see that.
Yeah, because there was a project like that. I'm trying to remember what it was. It was a science fiction movie later they did the same thing with. Frank had two sequences in it.
Well, because truthfully, me personally...
But it's like schizophrenic because the style changes every 15 seconds.
Well, see, that sounds delicious to me. Yeah. I think it's great.
But getting back to the whole point, Romero... There were zombie movies before Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, but
they were not the Romero zombies that have been displaced the original zombie.
Right.
Really, it was a voodoo thing. It was like the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, almost.
Right.
It was a...
White zombie.
Well, yeah, it was... You had a character who was possibly reanimated or possibly just possessed...
By magic and whatever.
Yeah, and they would go out and do the bidding, and there would be one of them.
But
Romero
George...
was, okay, let's have a horde... And they're not doing the bidding of anything. They're just a monstrous, destructive force.
He didn't agree to the term zombie until much, much later.
Yeah.
Because he thought it was a respect Simon Pegg will not to say that. What the said word? Don't say it. Why? Because it's ridiculous. Yeah. And what it was with George, he referred to them as ghouls.
Right.
And then just one day he's like, all right, damn it, they're zombies.
Yeah.
And he accepted the term.
Yeah, and that was, but that introduced that whole idea of
flesh
something
eating.
Turning, making the dead come to life and eat people.
Yes.
And that had not been done. And a lot of people saw political allegories in there.
It's conformity, man.
Yeah.
And like old Neil Fallon and Clutch says, you can't stop progress. You can't stop. No, no, no. And
right.
That's what it is. Zombies are basically people who wake up, go to work, come home, to bed.
That's actually
wake up.
Where Romero changed. You know, he didn't like the word himself, but he introduced it into the lexicon anyway.
Right.
The phrase Marvel zombies, before Robert Kirkman got a hold of it, used to mean people who just blindly buy everything Marvel published.
Yep.
And
I've been called that a few times
there
myself.
Are football zombies who just every Sunday morning just watch NFL.
College NFL zombie.
Yeah.
You know.
I don't consider college football. It's high school football.
Eh,
it's non-existent.
I don't even worry about all that mess.
But anyway, so just if that was the only movie he made, he changed the damn world.
Mm-hmm.
And
it
also
took him years to do it too.
Yeah, but the subtle commentary in that, where you have the hero is a black man. And he gets shot by a cop at the end. You know, no cops ever shot black men before that.
Nice shot. Right between the eyes. There's another one for the fire.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Fucking ouch, man.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Because no cops ever shot black men before.
No,
but seriously, that was, you know, the race relations were so tense at the time. That's 1968. This is the Chicago 8 or 6.
And
or
here's the beautiful thing. I've sat. For hours and watched George Romero documentaries and interviews. If he was still alive, and if he was standing here in front of both of us, he would say, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
He would be arguing the fact that movie was not about racism.
Yeah.
He would argue it down to its core.
It wasn't about racism.
But it damn sure turned into that.
It depicted everyday racism. It depicted a real-world setting.
Yeah, the crazy white guy who abused his wife, drank, smoked.
But what I mean is that he didn't set out to make a movie about racism, but he incorporated racism into it because it's part of everyday life. And if you have a black hero who is rescuing people, there's a good chance when the cops arrive on the scene, they're going to shoot him.
Not to mention the fact, Dwayne Jones was the first lead African American male ever. And he was, as far as it went, there was never a black lead actor in a major motion picture.
In a non-musical.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but as far as it went, through mainstream, nobody had ever done that before.
I think there might have been a black actor in a fellow, but there were also white actors who
did it. Yeah, yeah. Well, there was, because they did not. That was a huge taboo back then.
Yeah.
But George casted Dwayne not because of the color of his skin,
and what the
because the man actually could act and acted better than everyone else.
And the distributors threw a fit. Like, how the hell are we going to sell this in the South? And he's like, because there's ghouls eating people, and people will go see that.
And it was an he put the thing about George Romero. George and John Carpenter both do this, and that is why they're my favorite directors. That's why I consider new horror nowadays trash. That's why I consider a lot of other horror films trash. When I was growing up as a kid, I used to have across the street from my junior high a tanning bed that rented out VHS movies. So I had them all. Chopping Mall, Sleepaway Camp, Friday the 13th,
Nightmare on Elm Street. That's really a topic for a whole other show.
Well, I'm getting to that. Yeah. With those movies, they were all set up to fail. They were all set up to be corny, crappy, just sausage chop fests.
And that was the thing, was that Romero made real movies.
And he did, but the thing about him and John Carpenter, and this is what makes their horror films, or not their horror films, their films, poignant and stand on their own. They are everyday people in an everyday situation, in an everyday walk of life, with one small thing askewed. One small thing happens and fucks and contaminates the whole field.
And getting away from the storyline.
Monkey Shines?
Getting away from the storyline, the other influential thing about Night of the Living Dead was the budget was tiny.
It took them years to make it.
It was a micro budget. It was the first micro budget movie that caught on wide and had the quality to maintain a following. However, let's not do Mr. Romero an injustice and just focus on that movie.
No, no, hell no. There's other movies to talk about, and let's do it.
Let's
do
it. What was his next one after that, the next major one?
The Crazies.
The Crazies, which was sort of...
Another jab to the government.
Yeah.
Product placement, how the fact that all of a sudden this beautiful, sleepy little town in upstate Pennsylvania all just becomes psychotic, lunatic, incestual, cannibal psychopaths that kill each other, fuck each other, chop each other up, and burn each other alive.
Right, and again, it sort of followed the theme from Night of the Living Dead, but it took it out of the ghoulish zombie thing, more into, a more explainable.
Right, right. And it's some shit that has gone on.
Yeah.
And literally, it was as if the United States government, fuck you, by the way, actually went out of their way to go, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of places.
It was just coming out that the CIA had helped research and spread LSD, and then you had Agent Orange in Vietnam, you had chemical warfare.
The planes? But there are certain areas where you'll see those things, and crime is rampant like hell.
Yeah.
I've been watching and paying attention to that stuff, and I'm like, I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
I've seen chemtrails my entire life.
But I'll tell you what, I've seen some weird shit go down with certain things.
There's weird shit all over, but...
But Romero had a manner of that. But let's stop talking about that, because we could do a whole episode about the Crazies.
Yeah,
let's move on. I want a topic on a movie that features a dear friend of mine, a guy that I am blessed to consider a friend, Mr. John fucking Amplis. I love you, sir, and I hope you're listening, because I'm totally tagging you in this when we do this.
Yeah.
John Amplis' introduction to the world and to acting, as far as I was concerned, as far as I know, was in the brilliant 1972, movie Martin. A kid with a condition, but he wasn't necessarily a kid. He was 80 years old. And magically these women would end up dead, but without blood in their bodies. Mm-hmm. and the grandfather, or his, or whatever. I think it was the grandfather. Nosferatu.
It's probably been 35 years since I've seen it.
Oh, I have it autographed by Mr. Amplis, and he's such a lovely dude. And that's one place you see something you never see. Tom Savini, clean shaven, without a mustache.
Okay.
And a very young Christine Forrest, who later became Christine Forrest Romero, who became his longtime wife and producer and set designer. She did a lot of stuff for him. That movie shook me down to my bones, because everybody knows I don't like vampires.
Right.
But Martin wasn't a vampire. It was a vampire tale.
Was, because of the budgets and his own sensibilities, Romero did a lot of work in the horror genre. But he did one film that was not horror that stands out as one of my favorite films, and I haven't watched it forever.
What's that?
Knight Riders.
You know what? I was going to say something in between that.
Yeah.
In between Knight Riders and all that, there was a little YouTube video of him talking about The Walking Dead and stuff. And this one guy that was interviewing him, mm-hmm. cuts him off and says, "What do you think of this?" And there's Fred Rogers laying on a gurney. I can see their kind eyes and hear their kind voices as they're putting me under to operate. When Mr. Rogers gets a tonsillectomy,
mm-hmm.
directed by George
yeah.
fucking Romero.
Yeah.
And
plus, yeah, he was working in Pittsburgh.
Well, and I'll tell you what, I'm going to name drop somebody else.
Well, also, you know, Mr. Rogers was the originally cast as Bub, but he had to drop out.
Tasso. When Tasso was here at ShockerCon a few years ago, he was given a little thing, and me and my longtime brother, Brian Woods, was sitting side by side listening to him talk. And Brian was so taken by Knight Riders that it spawned him as a person. Mm-hmm. I mean, it made Brian Woods into Lord Brian Bearclaw.
Our listeners are not familiar. Knight Riders was basically a modern day retelling of the Legends of King Arthur.
It is, but
with guys on motorcycles.
Modern day.
Modern day. Okay.
What it was is him and Stephen King were driving. They had something going on. I think they were talking about the beginning scales of Creepshow.
Yeah.
The greatest horror film ever, if you ask me. And if you argue with me, find me and I'll argue with you why. While they were on a road, they happened to just look over. And there's these... I think they were looking at Pensacola War, if I'm not madly mistaken.
Yeah.
Two whole sides of men charging at each other, medieval style. Mm-hmm. With swords, shields, and he's like, "What in the fuck is that?" And him and Steven pull over. What in the hell is going on here? And it inspired him so much that he took a chance on a no-name actor by the name of Ed Harris. Mm-hmm. Wasn't he an Academy Award winner now?
Yeah.
Okay, Academy Award winner, Ed Harris, to play Billy Davis, who I actually wrote a song about with a previous band called The Ghosts of Now, owed to Billy Davis.
Actually put in the rotation on the air
last
week.
Thank you.
And, the odd thing about that was that I had forgotten the character's name,
mm-hmm.
but when I was in junior high, our school counselor was Billy Davis, and I was trying to figure out why you'd written a song about her.
No, that was him. That was probably my favorite part of that movie was the end, and I'm not going to ruin it, but it's that scene where he's hallucinating, mm-hmm. and he's riding the horse, and he's completely just decked out in his armor, riding that majestic mm-hmm. beast just so proudly. Because, you know, the shoulder was messing with him and everything.
Right.
When you watch the movie, it'll all be self-explanatory. But that movie really set standards for me.
We're going to jump around a little because we're getting near the end of our time.
Please,
I want to fit in a story.
Creepshow.
But you have to mention Creepshow, again, the anthology written with by Stephen King.
Hack. Sorry, yeah. Did I say that out loud?
Yeah. But
fuck him. He should have signed my book.
Get his son to sign it.
I'm going to.
Okay.
God damn it. Okay. I'll teach you to throw away my comic book. The only movie Joe Hill's ever played in, he was Little Billy.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great to have, like, Joe Hill and Tom Atkins' autographs on either side?
Yeah.
Because, really quick, everybody out there who doesn't know, one of my prized possessions is an original print
Bernie Wrightson drawn Creepshow comic that I got at Walden Books in 1983 at the Canal Mall when it first opened. Mm-hmm. And my first taste of this movie, before there was digital cable and all that business, if you couldn't watch a TV show, it was just scrambled. So I didn't have Cinemax. Mm-hmm. But Mom and Dad and Jolene were all in bed. Jolene was pregnant with Adam at the time. And here's little Lee sitting in front of his TV set with an ice-cold can of Coca-Cola, sitting Indian style, with only the light of the TV and the scrambling, listening to Creepshow, but reading it through the comic. Mm-hmm. That's personally what makes it the greatest film for me, because Romero's direction, I didn't see it until a little bit later,
when
VHS was a little bit easier. Right. And I paid $35 for my copy of it on VHS, mm-hmm. which I still have. Arguably, some of the best special effects.
Yeah.
I mean, the maggots crawling out of the eyes of Nathan Grantham, who was played by, yet again, my friend John Amplis. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, the roaches.
Yeah, what I'm afraid we're doing, though, is we're going to give short shrift to Dawn of the Dead, which was the second movie I ever crossed a picket line to see, and is my favorite.
Go ahead. Take the blame on that. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just going to say, we have to acknowledge that. And then Day of the Dead, which is not too shabby either.
As far as I'm concerned, it's the perfect zombie film. It is perfect. Yeah. I don't use that term often, but the special effects, Nicotero's...
We have another story we have to tell.
What's that?
You got to meet the father.
Oh! That's one of the things that does my heart... Well, I'm not going to mention the convention... Because he was very disenchanted with the place.
Yeah.
Because he flat out refused for his fans to pay, neighborhoods of higher up to $200 per photograph.
Yeah.
He refused. And, I wanted him to sign my arm, but he instead signed a piece of paper. And he said, just tell everybody I signed your friggin' arm. And, I mean, what really got me beforehand was when I was meeting the couple in front of us, guy laid out this beautiful poster of Night of the Living Dead. Beautiful, one flat. And he looks at it and smiles. He looks at the guy really big and smiled. Because at this time, George looked kind of sick.
Yeah.
He was very sick from the way it looked. And he smiled real big. The guy and went, would you like me to personalize it for you? And the guy went, no, just write Stay Scared, George Romero. And, you son of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Goddamn motherfucker. And I mean, you know, what George was basically saying is, I'll just personalize it. To eBay, suck my dick, George Romero. I mean, he was pissed because he knew what that guy was doing. But when I came to him with my stuff, battle-worn, beaten to pieces, autographs all over the place, to Lee, you know, a honky bastard from David Early, which really tickled him, but brought a tear to his eye because David Early's not with us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and he knew every signature. He knew everything. And when it was personalized to me, he's like, I don't have to write your name. I can just sign it. Mm-hmm. And he lit up to me. And I'm like, well, you can do that if you want. Mm-hmm. He's like, you know who you are.
Yeah.
And we laughed, but he wouldn't sign the arm because he said they frown on that. And if it gets back, I'll get in trouble, and I don't want to fucking deal with their shit anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of like, well, did he get in trouble? Who the fuck would smart off the father?
Mm-hmm.
Right when I'm going to leave, he's like, would you like a photograph? Would you like a picture? And I went, George, I spent $200 on autographs, $50 an autograph. I'd have paid $200 per autograph.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't have any money. Now you see why they're pissed off at me.
Mm-hmm.
And he grabs his chair and slams it down and says, sit down and get your friends to take a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And when I go to sit down, I feel this hand on, or I feel this weight on my back. And I'm like, what in the fuck? Oh my God, he's got his arm on me. George Romero's touching me. Oh my God. And I lean over and I'm holding him. And it's probably the last time in my life, I'm going to try to say this without crying, it was the last true time in my life that I actually smiled.
Wow.
I mean, truly, deeply smiled, because I waited my whole life to meet that man and thank him. the one thing I didn't get to do with Joey Ramone. Yeah. I didn't get to thank him for teaching me how shitty life could be. And telling me that there is no such thing as a happy ending or a light at the end of the tunnel. It's what you make of it. The world is a fucked up place. And sometimes you have to be just as fucked up as it to survive or have a little bit of sense to you when other people aren't acting properly. Let's just think of good old Captain Rhodes and Day of the Dead in that matter. You know, Sarah, Willie, and John, if you haven't watched Day of the Dead, shame on you. But
if you haven't watched Day of the Dead and you have a Roku, go to Shout Factory, where you can watch it. There'll be ads in it, but it's uncut. You can watch it with or without the commentary.
With the commentary? Oh, that commentary is great.
You've got Romero and Nicotero and the Savini on there.
Well, I didn't hear the one with Nicotero, but there's the one with George. What's her name? The lady that plays Sarah.
Yeah.
Chili Billy's daughter, Lori Cardell.
Yeah.
Lori Cardell and Tom Savini and George. Because I doubt Greg would sit beside of Tom for too long.
Maybe they just talk about him.
They mention him a whole lot because.
Yeah.
Tom refused to admit that he was the one that invented the latex flesh. Yeah. But think about it. It was always duct tape and makeup was what Tom used for the rending flesh.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden that, when they popped that flesh, it would pop and snap in the blood. That's Nicotero's staple. Yeah. And actually, Day of the Dead was Nicotero's first acting credit.
Right. But anyway,
that is
the
we can do a whole episode about Nick.
That is the lineage between George Romero. One of the lines between George Romero and The Walking Dead. Even though Romero was not the biggest fan of The Walking Dead,
because they straight up ripped him off in a lot of ways.
They ripped off his setting, his premise, but they didn't focus on the same people. That he did.
Well, and not just
they introduced more soap opera serial entertainment elements.
They made, and they didn't make the zombies like normal everyday people. The Cardigan zombie.
Yeah.
The Hare Krishna zombie.
Right.
The nurse zombie. The football player. The clown. The fisherman. The rock band. You know, all the zombies in The Walking Dead all look the same. And he hated that. They're all rotted, and they all have the same face. There's no individuality with the zombies. It's just a horde.
That's why they need to introduce the pranksters.
Yeah. Why not? I mean, well, even in the comic book, the zombies look more different than they do in the show.
Right.
And
but let's get back to Romero.
Okay.
Let's talk about the non-horror work.
Bruiser.
Yeah.
Bruiser. Jason Fleming's performance as the Faceless and Tom Atkins opposed to him as the cop hunting him down, and Peter Stormare. As Milo, the prick boss, that's a role. If you've never seen Bruiser, again, people stop watching these bad fucking movies that are out and go watch Romero's films. They are movies you can relate to. And I'm not going to get into the whole reason why Bruiser is incredible, but the Misfits appear in it and actually play a couple of songs in it. They write the title track, the song Bruiser. Mm-hmm. But it's... There is so much depth to that movie. Harry Creedlow. Henry Creedlow.
Romero is not just a horror director.
No!
He directed full stories with beginnings, middles, ends, depth, characterization, plot development, social commentary.
And social commentary was what he was best at.
Yeah.
I mean, he just.
And he did this within a thankless genre that doesn't get the respect. That, in his case, it deserves.
Or him, for that matter. Right. He didn't even get the respect he deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And still that irks me. But I'll tell you what, while we're on it, how about I give a middle finger to two things that I didn't appreciate that he put out.
Okay.
Fuck Season of the Witch. What a tear. I saw where he was going with it.
Yeah.
A boring, unhappy housewife.
See, here's the thing. A successful, daring, experimental filmmaker... is occasionally going to miss the mark.
And with me personally, I think he did with that movie. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a couple friends of mine who find Knight Riders to be that. And I look at him, I'm like, you're out of your goddamn mind. Mm-hmm. That movie's incredible. No!
Yeah.
No!
That's it.
No!
This is the show of the living dead.
Survival of the dead, too. I see where you were going with the war in the Middle East factor, but I wasn't impressed with it.
Okay. Anyway, that's it. We have wrapped up the first word association of 2017. And you know what's really funny?
What?
This is like on Fridays, our most listened to show on the air.
What?
And we've been in reruns for like 10 months.
What? No! People aren't listening to us jabber.
We've been running it at 9 o'clock in the morning on Fridays, and people listen. And we will have new episodes now probably Wednesdays at 7:30 following Life Speaks to Michelle Zirkel.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
And since we're doing new ones, I might pop it into another time slot.
That's what she said.
Yeah, that is what she said. And having said that.
I headed him off at the pass, folks.
Yeah, that's what she said. But.
God damn it.
I am Rudy Panucci.
I'm Lee Hara.
Check in next time for Word Association.
Stay scared. We love you, George. Rest in peace.
Right.
Word Association with Lee Hare and Rudy Panucci is brought to you by General Substances.
If it's composed of matter, we have a hand or two in it.
Chapter Pain the Piper. Nowhere to run. I've come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm out of bubblegum. Dr. Pay the Piper, don't be a fool. I was rowdy before rowdy was cool. From the great white north, this titan did come. Well, he's been on his own ever since he was young. Well, his first fight was a failure of recorded time. So begins the tale of this legend's life. Time to pay the piper. Nowhere to run. I've come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum. The Piper, don't be a fool, because I was rowdy before rowdy was cool. When the beat talks, the people listen. The blood, the broken glass, and sweat, it pours in this. Well, his roar, his screams, his scratching ass. His freakish round, but still not going up, was worth the coming down. Time to pay the piper, nowhere to run. I'm drunk in a chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum. Time to pay the piper, rise to your feet. Life's a bitch, my brother. She's fucking. Bring it on! Come here to-
gonna chew bubble gum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubble gum. I'm a baby bye-bye. Don't be a fool. He was rowdy before. Rowdy at the school. You paid the piper. It's moving fast. When RP came to your town, RP kicked your ass.
We came out of one of Lee's heroes in word association with Lee and Rudy to another one in the song Pay the Piper. That was Hera with Lee's tribute to the late Roddy Piper. I also did a video for that that you will probably see in the next video edition of Radio Free Charleston. You know, Lee had a lot of heroes, and he was very proud of them. He didn't wear them on his sleeve. He wore a lot of them on his arm. He was also more of a history buff than people realized. And here's Stone Quartet with a song that demonstrates that. It's Patton's Blues on Radio Free Charleston on the air.
We'll be right back.
Okay, after Patton's Blues, you heard Ozzy Osbourne with Crazy Train. I've posted video of Lee doing that song with Hera. He was trying to get into a movie based on Ozzy's life, and it was a fun time. After that, we played Iron Maiden again with Hallowed Be Thy Name, one of Lee's favorite songs of all time, as you will hear, because we are going to play out this episode with one more episode of Word Association with Lee and Rudy. Before we get there, first I want to remind everybody, support the local scene. Lee always supported the local scene. Also, a lot of people are missing Lee this week, and I have some stuff in my vault here at the air. So for the remainder of this week, at 5 p.m., you will hear a three-hour block of Harris Hard and Heavy mixed with Word Association with Lee and Rudy. And then on Sunday, December 7th, starting at 9 a.m. and running until 8 p.m., you will hear more of Lee talking, introducing music, having fun. Right now, I want to thank everybody for listening, and I want everybody to take a moment to remember Lee Hera. Here's one more episode of Word Association with Lee and Rudy on Radio Free Charleston on the air. Here's how it works. Each week, Lee Hera and Rudy Panucci sit down and spend half an hour discussing a random topic. Lee Hera never knows in advance what that topic will be. Sometimes Rudy Panucci doesn't know either. Time is kept by a little kitchen timer shaped like an Italian chef whom we have named Luigi. Sit back for half an hour of random talk. The views and opinions expressed in Word Association with Lee Hera and Rudy Panucci are not representative of anyone. Proceed at your own risk. Welcome to a special episode of Word Association with Lee and Rudy.
What's so special about it?
What's so special about it? We're going to talk about a topic that is actually going to spin off into another program here on the air.
What about?
We're going to talk about great albums. And some of these great albums, the ones you pick, are going to be heard on your other program, Harris Hard and Heavy.
I like the sound of that.
And by albums, I mean collections of songs by musical artists that make up a CD of vinyl release or a group of MP3s bundled together and sold on iTunes or whatever.
Right,
but
right.
It's an album. It's a musical album by a musical artist. And I don't know what the hell's parked outside, but it's driving me nuts.
You can walk from where you are.
I think it's a damn garbage truck. It's just sitting out there. I hope they didn't pick recording day to... I can cut this shit out.
That's fine.
Anyway. All right. Like it's quiet. All right, but anyway, so we've defined what an album is. And you're laughing so hard, I'm going to make you pick the first one. And actually, I'm going to pick it for you and have you talk about it.
Good for it.
Iron Maiden's Number of the Beast.
Oh.
Would you consider that a great album?
Next to Slayer's Rain and Blood, it is the quintessential heavy metal album. Because it has everything a heavy metal album should have. It has an incredible album cover. Literally, from the first track to the last track, it is liquid fire. I mean, it's explosive, it's powerful, it's timeless, it's heavy. Also, another fact that that a great heavy metal album has to have, an incredible producer, the legendary Martin Birch, which was his second effort with the band, because Killers was his first. He would have done the first album, but the guys in Iron Maiden didn't think that he was, they didn't think they were big enough. Mm-hmm. And he felt slighted by them not asking him first
So he almost balked on doing Killers. Mm-hmm. But when Rod Smallwood, Maiden's manager, said, look, they didn't think you would do it because, you know, you've done Fleetwood Mac, Rainbow, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple. The list goes on and on. You know, we didn't think that you would consider us big enough fish. Well, I would have done the damn album and half the price as well. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, will you do this one? Yes. Mm-hmm. And after that, that was a relationship that carried all the way to 1991.
Now.
But Number of the Beast was also Bruce Dickinson's first album. Mm-hmm. Their original singer, well, not their original singer, the third or fourth singer of the band, Paul Di'Anno, suffered with culture shock, with success, with drug abuse, and with a lot of psychological issues. He just couldn't do it. So in between the recording or the writing sessions, at the time, the best singer in England in the new wave of British heavy metal was this gallant, flashy singer with balls named Bruce Bruce, who later, of course, became Bruce Dickinson, who, of course, sang on that album. The other thing that makes a heavy metal album great, and a lot of people will argue with me on this, it's got to have Satan in it somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's got to have it to where people are going, oh, my goodness. Well, back then, you know, nowadays, that's everybody's got a pentagram on something if you're playing heavy metal. It's become so done to death. Mm-hmm. But that was the album was named after a frigging Bible verse. Mm-hmm. And the chorus goes 666, the number of the beast. When you come over from England, and you have the Bible Belt children raising their fists in the air chanting 666, you know you're in trouble. You know, already we considered Ozzy Osbourne Satan himself for accidentally biting the head off a bat. What are they going to say about these British guys coming over singing that with a big zombie on the album cover, puppeting the devil?
Biting the head off a bat? Huh? Just mean to kiss it?
No, people used to throw rubber animals on the stage. Yeah. And he picked that one up and didn't realize it was real until he bit into it. And Sharon was like, dummy, it's real. And he looks down, sees the blood and all that, and he just looks at her, oh, shit.
Anyway.
But anyhow, yeah.
One of the songs on that album, just so people know.
The first song is just a fireball called Invaders. And it was about how the Nords, the Goths and all those people had taken over England, the Anglo-Saxon England, in the early, and about the time when the Vikings were pushing outward towards the North Americas, these guys from the south, the Moors, the Goths, and all them were coming up and destroying the United Kingdom. That's where the words of curse came from and all that. That's where curse words came from.
Okay.
So there was that. Then the second song was a brilliant love note to Children of the Damned, one of the creepiest damn horror films of all time.
Yep.
The third song, The Prisoner, brilliant TV show with the legendary Patrick McGoohan, who, funny enough, they call him in L.A. to ask him if they could use that opening segment to their song. And the manager, Rod Smallwood, yes, I'm calling about asking about, using the thing. I'm not the free man, I'm the number. And he's getting it all wrong. And Bruce is over there losing his mind because that was Bruce's favorite TV show.
Yeah.
And he's going to kick your ass. It's all wrong. No, no, no. Very quietly, whole minute passes on the phone and you hear Patrick McGoohan go, do it. Click. There it is.
Yeah.
And then, of course, 22 Acacia Avenue, the song which is basically Charlotte the Harlot Part 2. For all you Maidenheads out there, you know about that. If not, if you're not a Maidenhead, go learn. Then, of course, side 2, the title track, Number of the Beast, which is a mainstay in Iron Maiden sets to this very day. Mm-hmm. Then after that, they're probably their biggest hit next to The Trooper. It was the first hit they ever had worldwide, which was Run to the Hills. Very political song, very crazy song, told from during the Wild West era when the white man was pushing the Indians out. It was told from both sides. One of the best and funniest songs. The video's hilarious. Yeah. You have Gangland, which is the song about Chicago gangsters. Mm-hmm. Then the song that didn't make the original cut of the album, but was written by the late, great Clyde Burr, the drummer of the album. Incredible jazz drummer. MS just ate him up. Bless his heart. Well, that when they started doing revamped versions of the album, they put that one on there. Mm-hmm. Last but not friggin' least, my absolute favorite Iron Maiden song, Hallowed Be Thy Name. Arguably, probably one of the greatest heavy metal songs ever written, because it is written from the standpoint of a man sitting in jail, staring at a gallows pole, waiting for his time to die. And the music, the energy, the power, the sadness, the anger, the grief. It is clearly one of the greatest songs ever, because it goes through all those personalities and those feelings.
And that album will turn up on an episode of Harris Hard and Heavy.
You damned right it will.
Because you're going to bring the spotlight to your favorite albums.
Your
influential albums of all time. We have a new show here on the air called Mystery Hour.
Oh.
And I can't really say what it is, but occasionally if you
do... Well, it wouldn't be a mystery if you did.
You might hear an entire album or something. And the first episode of the Mystery Hour has already aired.
Really?
Yes.
Hmm.
I mean, it's very little fanfare. It pops up when you least expect it.
Oh.
It is an alternate version of my pick for one of the greatest albums of all time, which is actually the first music album I ever bought. Because I was not originally into music. I was into comedy. Right. I buy comedy albums. The first albums I bought were, I bought a Bill Cosby stand-up album. I bought Monty Python albums. I would go to Budget to get Monty Python albums out of the cutout bin, because they were like $2.99. And I heard a novelty single that was played on Dr. Demento, and I was like, that's really funny. I think I will get it. And it turned out to be quite a mind-expanding journey. That song was Don't Eat the Yellow Snow by Frank Zappa. And when I found the album it was on, I got the first rock album I bought was Frank Zappa's Apostrophe, which is an amazing album. I still listen to it to this day. And the Zappa Family Trust has just released an album called The Crux of the Biscuit, which is primarily alternate takes and extended versions of the songs from that album.
What a nut.
But that whole album, aside from the entire saga of Nanook, which goes on through four songs, beyond Don't Eat the Yellow Snow.
Was that the album that LSP had?
Yes, it was. It was on. It turned up on Adventure Time, because it's that important an album. But
You've
got not just, you know, Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, which goes into Nanook Rubs It, which is where Nanook takes the yellow snow to blind the evil hunter who has beaten his favorite baby seal with a lead-filled snowshoe. And then the hunter goes wandering off because he can't see, and has to go to the parish of St. Alfonso, because that's the only place where you can get it fixed up. And
oh my God.
That shows up during St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast. And that takes up like most of side one of the album.
Oh my God.
Now, there are other incredible songs. I believe either the first or last song on side one is Cosmic Debris, which is a separate song, which I still quote to this day. Whenever anybody mentions the word poncho, I always ask, is that a real poncho or a Sears poncho? The thing is, the music is so complex and progressive, and there's even instrumentals on it. The band included George Duke, and I think Ainsley Dunbar played drums on it. And
wow!
Yeah, it's just an amazing collection of musicians, and the music is complex and intelligent.
I always liked Ainsley Dunbar's drums. Yeah. He always did the best fills.
Yeah, but it was just an amazing album. Then you get to side two, and you get this song called Extravagal Force. I should probably be reading it to get it right. Excentrivagal Force. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
But the lyrics are just like almost poetry over top of this incredible music. There's a long instrumental cut. There's a song called Uncle Remus, which is a statement on racism that is actually incredible. It's sung from sung by Zappa from the point of view of a black man, and I think it might be co-written with George Duke. And it's just this incredible gospel-tinged thing about going to Beverly Hills just before dawn to knock the little jockeys off the rich people's lawns, you know, and just incredible, incredible piece of music, very powerful. I can almost sing that if a band would back me, but
I
don't know that I would have the guts to. But
I still don't believe that man didn't do drugs.
He didn't. Yeah.
I don't buy it.
He's my role model.
I don't buy it. That
I don't do drugs. Yeah.
No, but you sure as hell screw with people who do.
That's the fun part.
Oh, you.
But anyway, that's Apostrophe by Frank Zappa. My favorite Frank Zappa album, and that's out of over 100.
Wow.
And it should rank near the top of anybody's list. But why don't you throw me another one?
Let me think here.
You mentioned Slayer.
Yeah. Again, all the things that make a heavy metal album incredible. Mm-hmm. Great album cover, great producer, heavy music, and Satan. I just described Slayer's Rain and Blood.
Okay.
And, I mean, like, I remember as a kid, I almost felt like I was buying porn, buying this album in a tape store. And because my dad was, he wasn't really religious, because he cussed like a sailor and he drank like a fish. But he still, I don't want to mess with them there damn demon worshippers. Uh-huh. And when he saw the album cover to Rain and Blood about a few months prior, he's like, "Is that the devil on a chair? Is that the Pope carrying the devil on a chair? Mm-hmm. What are they wait? Are they waiting around in blood? Is that a naked woman with arrows sticking out of her belly?" And she's like, "They cut her head off." Oh my God, you are not buying this album. Well, I didn't. I stole it. And so I listen to that constantly. And what's crazy about that album is it's so short.
Yeah.
That it's on side one and side two.
Uh-huh.
But some of the greatest riffs from a band that didn't even know how to play their instruments yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's what gave it its charm.
Right.
Because Kerry's going up and down that neck, him and Jeff both, and they're playing wrong notes like a mug.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just incredible. But Dave Lombardo's drumming, Tom Araya's high pitch, and all that. Mm-hmm. It was hell. Like Scotty Ian said about Slayer, if I'm in hell, I expect Slayer to be the soundtrack. That or Ricky Martin.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, just the production, Rick Rubin's brilliant production on that.
Mm-hmm.
The guy literally slathers himself in controversy.
Mm-hmm.
He did the first Danzig album, which is another one I'll mention later on. That was another timeless album. He did Andrew Dice Clay's first album.
Yeah.
He did the Black Crowes' first album. He did the Ghetto Boys self-titled album, which had a disclaimer on it, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so Rick Rubin just had this gear.
This short, intense, heavy metal blast.
Yeah.
And also, according to Brian Posehn, anything you're doing, if you say Slayer, you're not gay.
No, including going down another guy.
Right.
And so, that's straight from Brian Posehn's mouth.
Oh, we got it. Unsaid.
Yes, I was hoping you would.
We'll move on to another album, and I am avoiding mentioning Beatles stuff here because
it's too
easy. You know, Devo's second album, "Duty Now for the Future."
Ooh.
It didn't have a hit on it. They didn't have a superstar producer. They had Ken Scott, who has actually got incredible chops and a tie to the Beatles.
Ooh.
But it was. If you were a Devo fan, a real Devo fan from the first album, then you loved the second album.
Right.
Because it had one cover, Secret Agent Man.
Oh.
It had a song that contributed to the Devo mythology, Smart Patrol Mr. DNA. It opened with an instrumental, the Devo corporate anthem. And it just had these incredible songs. Timing X, The Day My Baby Gave Me a Surprise, which is sort of a goofy thing. The hilarious Be Bad video. What's the other one? Strange Pursuit, Swelling Itching Brain, Timing X. This is incredible songs. Clock Out, another great one, that really are more punk than new wave.
Really?
Yeah, and the production is incredible on it. The Ken Scott, who played harpsichord on the White Album and was an engineer at Abbey Road.
Holy shit.
Yeah. What's really funny is, you know who else was an engineer on the White Album?
Hmm.
Chris Thomas.
Really?
Yeah, the guy that produced the Sex Pistols and most of the first Pretenders album. But anyway, Devo's second album, Duty Now for the Future, before they had the flower putt hats, you know, before they used keyboards almost exclusively, they still had a lot of guitar on that album. With Alan Myers' incredible drumming before he left the band. It's just an incredible collection of songs, and they were sort of at their peak, and they hadn't gotten corrupted by big record label money and cocaine. More cocaine than money, in their case. But it's to me, it's my favorite Devo album. I remember buying it at Budget Tapes and Records in Cross Lanes. Because they had three stores at one time. They had one on Capitol Street,
mm-hmm.
and they had one on in Cross Lanes, in a little strip mall that the half they were in burned down, but they had already closed the store by then. Right past the stoplight, and you'd go to Budget. When I was learning to drive, that was one of the places my dad would just let me get behind the wheel and drive to. And before I had my license or anything.
Wow.
And yeah, that's where I got the Devo second album. That's where I got my first Kate Bush album. And John Nelson was managing that one both times.
Wow.
So, but that's my pick. Why don't we have another one? You mentioned Danzig.
Actually, let me head you off at the pass there. I had to look at this and make sure my facts were right.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Ramones fan.
Oh, yeah. We got to get that in there.
And as far as I'm concerned, I could sit for hours and talk about each album.
Mm-hmm.
But out of them, my favorite Ramones album is the image of Joey that I have tattooed on me. Yeah. And it's from the brilliant 78 classic Road to Ruin.
Mm-hmm.
Road to Ruin is strange for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
That was Marky Ramone's first album because Tommy just, he couldn't handle being in the band anymore.
Right.
The stress of the band, he would have even told you himself, I'm not a fucking drummer, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Why they got me to be a drummer? Because nobody else could be a drummer. We thought Joe would be a better singer than a drummer. So I ended up just being the drummer just so we could go on. Well, they got established enough at this point after putting out three albums, which, you know, it's always the third or fourth album with a band.
Yeah.
And they ended up getting Marky from Richard Hell. And Tommy didn't leave the band completely.
He stayed on the management, didn't he?
He stayed on to produce with Ed Statham. And that album was also the album that was featured all throughout Rock and Roll High School,
mm-hmm.
which was my introduction to the band.
Yeah. And a little side note about that. You know the uncredited co-director of Rock and Roll High School?
Uh-uh.
Joe Dante.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that.
I just read that the other day. I was like, I didn't even know that.
I can totally see that. Because Roger Corman, as long as his name's on it,
yeah.
he don't care who else gets credit.
Mm-hmm.
So I can totally see that. And I mean, but you have songs like, Of Course I Want to Be Sedated.
Yeah.
I Just Want to Have Something to Do.
Mm-hmm.
Don't Come Close. I'm Against It. You know, all these just classic, questioningly, arguably, probably the Ramones' first ballad that they wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And what just a gutting song.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm going to interrupt you right now to say, we'll probably revisit this topic several times.
Oh, yeah. And that album really set standards for me as a kid.
Now, the interesting thing is, my pick for my favorite Ramones album is one that a lot of Ramones fans hate.
It's the one after that one.
The one after that, a lot of the Ramones themselves sort of hated.
I didn't. I loved it.
End of the Century, which I bought because Phil Spector produced it, because of the Beatles connection.
It was the album the band wanted, but they just didn't know what they had to go through to get it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Phil was hell-bent on breaking that band up. Because he didn't want... Marky was his drinking buddy.
Yeah.
Dee Dee was annoying. He fucking hated Johnny. Hated Johnny. That's why he made Johnny play the opening riff to Rock and Roll High School over 200 times in one setting. And even threatened him with a gun. You're going to play that part.
That's what gets me about this, is that they had to have heard the stories about Phil Spector going in.
It was Joey, man. Joey pushed the band to do it. Because he loved Phil
guy
so much.
You know, fired off a gun in the studio with John Lennon and Stevie Wonder and Paul McCartney in it one time. Because there's actually little known fact that McCartney showed up at an L.A. studio at a Phil Spector produced John Lennon session, and everybody was so stoned and drunk that nothing usable came from it. I've heard the bootlegs of it. There's a song the Plasmatics recorded where for the middle part of the song they decided to isolate each member in a different room so that they couldn't hear what the other one was playing. It sounds sort of like a band falling down a flight of stairs with all their equipment. That's sort of like what the L.A. sessions sounded like.
Well, the thing was, Phil, like I said, I didn't get to Joey.
Yeah.
When he got to Joey, he would get him off to the side and say, "You're the next Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
Drop those losers. Let me take you. I'm telling you, we could make something happen here."
Yeah, and we need to point out also at this point that by this point, Phil Spector was no longer a major force in the industry.
No.
He had not had a hit for over a decade. The last hit he had was producing, just basically remixing the Beatles' Let It Be.
Right. And Joey didn't do it because he was so loyal to his band.
Yeah.
He would not betray the respect of the Ramones. And after that, Phil kind of looked at him different.
Yeah.
He got through stuff. He always babied Joey, where he would be hard on Johnny, a little hard on Dee Dee. Whatever Marky did was fine. And Johnny would even tell him, the drums on this are weak. You shut your mouth! You shut your stupid hair mouth! You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, he was just so on everybody else but Marky and Joey.
Yeah.
And that's why their tracks, listen to Baby, I Love You.
Yeah.
When Johnny come in to play the guitar parts, get out of here. He told them all, recording's done for the day, I just need Joey. And he brought in that symphony.
Yeah.
And boy, you didn't do that to John Cummings.
Right.
You didn't do that to his band.
Right.
And he's like, that's crap and da da da.
I'd imagine that would give them something to bond with McCartney over. Because McCartney's not fond of Phil Spector.
Is he really not? Was he not?
No, that's why the Let It Be Naked album came out, because McCartney always hated the production that Phil Spector did on that album. Because the whole idea of, the Long and Winding Road was it was supposed to be a bare naked ballad with McCartney and piano. And he even re-recorded it as a solo artist in the 80s on that movie soundtrack he did. But he so hated Phil Spector's, and all, Glenn Johns, who engineered and was credited as a producer, said it was an insult to McCartney, the production that Phil Spector laid on that. He brought in the female chorus and strings and everything else to lay over top of the Beatles. And the whole point of the Get Back album was it was the Beatles with no studio tricks, because they were like, we're going to get in and record an album, and we're going to film the process, which was the death knell for it. They owed United Artists a movie. And you're like, we'll make a documentary about making our album. And the plan was to do an album that's stripped down with no studio tricks, with no overdubs. If they needed an extra musician, he got credit on it. That's why Billy Preston is the only artist to have credit, on label credit, playing with the Beatles. And that completely went out the window with Phil Spector producing it. Because the idea was they were going to take it on tour. They were going to tour again. And that fell apart as the band was falling apart while they were making the movie. Because the movie process was so unpleasant because they couldn't get the film cameras in Abbey Road. Abbey Road was like, it's too disruptive. So they had to basically set up an impromptu recording studio on a film studio. In a film studio. And they tried to record some stuff at Apple Records. They brought this guy in named Magic Alex, who was either an idiot or a con man, depending on which version you believe. And he built them this equipment that doesn't work. And they recorded on it, but there's always these hideous squeaks and squawks that come through in the middle, running by beautiful tanks.
Oh.
But, of course, it's all preserved on bootlegs because it's the most heavily bootlegged album sessions of all time.
Oh.
But anyway, it was just so miserable getting up in the morning to record on the music, because they had to go by the Teamsters' schedules, so they had to record in the daytime, which wasn't what they did. So they had to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning to start making music. And on top of that, they'd been together long enough, and they weren't fond of each other. And that's it, and we ended up talking about the Beatles after all. But anyway, we had some great albums that you're going to hear on here, because I wouldn't be surprised if Duty Now for the Future shows up on a Mystery Hour. And I wouldn't be surprised if Ramones and Slayer and Iron Maiden show up on Harris Hard and Heavy.
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay. That is it for Word Association this week. Check out our Facebook page.
Yes. Like us.
Yes, like us.
I've been noticing the activity. So good job. But you can always do better.
Yeah, try harder, folks. That's it for us. I'm Rudy.
And I'm Lee.
Come back next time.
And enjoy good music.
Radio Free Charleston is brought to you by General Substances. If it's composed of matter, we have a hand or tube in it.